So today I'm going to be talking to Gautam Baid, and by way of brief introduction, you should know that I've only met Gautam in person once, and that was at the book signing of his book at Creighton University at, I think it was the most recent or the penultimate most recent Berkshire Hathaway meeting. But a couple of years prior, Gautam had sent me a copy of his book, and I felt so much empathy to you, Gautam, because I felt like I understood a lot of what you had gone through to produce such an extraordinary manuscript. And at the same time, I agreed very much with a lot of what you were saying in the book and the way you'd gathered together so much wisdom, modern wisdom, if you like, from so many places. And then what happened to me is that I was inspired to write something for the book. But then I was absolutely floored when Gautam decided. I told Gautam, I seem to remember that I said, Gautam, I'm going to provide you with a blurb, and then you're going to go out and get a far better blurb. And I really expected you to do it. And I was just honored when you put me into the foreword of the book. But so that's my story with Gautam. And since then, the book has been reprinted by Columbia Business Press. A friend of mine, Malice Thompson, loves the book, and I think it's done extraordinarily well. But I guess where I'm going to start with you, Gautam, is can you tell a little bit about the story of your life up to the point where you started to write the book? So Gautam Baid pre-writing The Power of Compounding, and before the idea even came into your head, can you give us a sense of who you are and where you came from?
Sure, guy. Thank you for having me here. So I come from a Marwari family in India, and I'm the youngest of the four siblings in my family. And as all Indians know, we Marwari community have got business in our genes. So ever since my teenage years, I was always fascinated by the concept of entrepreneurship, especially by the fact that once a solid foundation is established for a business, the owners don't work for money. Rather, money works for them. I did my graduation in commerce with a specialization in accountancy. So pursuing higher studies in the field of finance seemed like a natural extension. So I did my MBA in finance from Nirmal University, Ahmedabad, India. And I did my MS in finance from ICFI University, Hyderabad, India. Later on, I also went on to obtain my CFA charter from the CFA Institute, US. After completing the MBA program, I got a campus placement with Citibank as an investment banking analyst at their Mumbai, India office, where I worked for 3 years. And from there on, I joined Deutsche Bank as a senior analyst in their investment banking team, wherein I worked for 4 years at their Mumbai, London, and Hong Kong offices.
Now, I need you to pause just a second. Sorry. Thank you so much. This is great. But I just want to rewind. Do I understand that you grew up in Ahmedabad?
I grew up in Kolkata, in East India.
Kolkata. Okay. You studied in Ahmedabad. Just take a moment. It's only because I've traveled to India multiple times that I understood the word Marwari. But for those of our listeners who are not Marwaris, they need to understand what this is about. And perhaps you can explain a little bit about what it means to be a Marwari in India.
So basically, in India, there are two particular communities, the Marwadis and the Gujaratis, who are very prominent and well-known for establishing businesses and going down the route of entrepreneurship. So many other communities pursue, you know, a career, a professional career, like a job. But the Marwadis and Gujaratis in India are basically entrepreneurs by nature. So that is, you know, I was born and brought up in a, you know, business family. It was a very small scale business. But since observing how the business dynamics works, I was always very interested in this business line. So that's why I also pursued commerce in graduation.
And the listener needs to know that I met your father at the time that there was the book signing taking place, and never has there been a prouder dad. And it was just lovely that he accompanied you. And I would tell you that my father has accompanied me on some things, but it's just always lovely. And those moments are to be cherished. They're very, very special moments when your father can accompany you on a success like that. And I know that you'd gone on from this, but can you tell me and the listener a little bit about your decision to come to the United States? I mean, you'd now studied 2 degrees in India, and India is a burgeoning place. What made you decide to come to the US and pursue a career in the US rather than stay in anyone? You could have stayed perhaps in and around the family and the businesses that your family have, or gone to Mumbai or Delhi or Calcutta? Tell us the story.
So let me share the background story for this. It's a pretty interesting story. So let me start with how I got started in the stock market in the first place, because that has got the main connection to me coming to the US. So just like most individuals get their beginning in the stock markets, even I was pulled into the stock market out of sheer greed during the final euphoric phases of a bull market. In my case, it was the 2003 to 2007 bull market in India. I still remember I had invested in a mutual fund called Reliance Power Sector Mutual Fund and a stock named Ispat Steel and Power, because both of them were in the hot and fancy sectors of power and steel at the time. And both those investments had sharply appreciated in the most recent period. So I just engaged in blind extrapolation of the recent price trends in them and just did not pay any heed to their business models or valuations. And I got sucked in. And vividness and recency biases are very powerful but highly costly behavioral mistakes. Both those investments of mine crashed 70 to 80% within 12 to 18 months of my purchase. And I had successfully gained my admission into the stock markets by paying my admission fee. Despite this bad initial experience, my interest about the stock markets always remained very high all throughout the first 7 years of my investment banking career. And one fine day, I came to this big realization that, hey, we just have this one short life to live our dreams. And I did not want to waste any further time doing something that I was not really truly passionate about. I was earning good money as an investment banking analyst in India, but I was not getting that job satisfaction. I was not really happy during those 14, 15 hours I'd work every day. It was more like just doing a mechanical kind of work. So I was so keen for a career shift that in May 2015, I relocated to the United States without any job in hand. One of my relatives who's a US citizen, he sponsored my green card. And I was under the impression that since I'm a CFA charter holder, I'm like the master of the universe in the world of finance. I'll easily get a stock market job because this particular degree is highly valued in the investment management industry. But alas, as you know, life is not a bed of roses for those trying to carve their own destiny. I got rejected in my first three stock market job interviews in the first 6 months in the US. And at the same time, I kept declining all investment banking job interviews that came my way, even though they would have offered very high dollar salaries. I was refusing them. And I hid this entire fact from my family back in India. I was very firm and adamant that I'm not going to go back to that previous field of work where the presence of incentive cost bias always led to conflicts of interest and did not suit my personal nature. It was a jungle out there, basically. And during those first 6 months, you know, I also ran out of whatever little money I'd brought with me from India. And to take care of my living expenses in the US, I took up a minimum wage job as a front desk clerk at a hotel in San Francisco, where I worked for 15 months in the graveyard shift. Now, for the uninitiated, the graveyard shift refers to the shift which runs from 11 p.m. at night to 7 a.m. in the morning. Even though it was a big challenge for me, intellectually, emotionally, physically. But in hindsight, I really highly value those days of my life because for the first time since the beginning of my corporate career and those 7 long busy years, I finally got some time for myself to read and learn. And this was the phase in my life during which I was laying down the building blocks for compounding in my life.
So hold on a second, because I've got questions that I realize I'm not going to get. If we don't go back to them now, I won't be able to. So you applied for 3 jobs in investing and failed to get all 3. Now, I identify a lot with that because, you know, where my book starts is where I'm failing everywhere to get jobs. And in my case, I was in the US with a great degree, but I'd trashed my resume by going to work for the wrong place. Do you remember the names of the places that rejected you?
I cannot recall them off the top of my head, but all 3 were in San Francisco. That much I remember.
But you were crashing and burning, basically. And yeah, so you got sponsored for a green card and you moved to San Francisco. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's also, it's the middle of the tech boom Silicon Valley's been going through a tech boom for quite a while. But so you weren't tempted in any way, shape or form to get involved. You knew that you were headed for something stock market related.
I wanted to get on the buy side, basically. So yeah. even though it was very tempting, all those six-figure dollar salaries which were being offered in those investment banking job interviews here, the thing is, I was so clear in my mind that I'm not going to go back to that particular line of work. Then what was the point of coming all the way to the US? I was under the impression that since I'm a CFA charter holder, I'll easily get a stock market job. That is what I want to do in life. I was very clear.
And so you take a job on this graveyard shift at a hotel. Do you remember the name of the hotel by any chance?
Yes, of course. How can I forget? Those were the defining moments of my life. So it was Four Points by Sheraton and near the San Francisco Bay Bridge.
Hilarious. And just to get some context, so, you know, so just to understand at this point, because you started talking about the building blocks of compounding, and I'm curious to know if at this point you've even heard about Warren Buffett, or is that still to come in the story?
No, I'd heard about him. In fact, in my book, I've written about it as well, that I discovered Warren Buffett and value investing in late 2013.
So bring us to Summit Global Investors and the inception of your book.
Yes. So like I said, those 15 months at the hotel was, you know, where I actually built, you know, laid down the building blocks for compounding in my life. So the pace of work during late night to early morning at the hotel was pretty slow. And I made full use of the free time to read up every single blog article published from beginning till date on blogs like Janav WordPress, Safal Niveshak, Pandu Professor, B-Sit Investing, and Microcap Club, among others. And the passionate pursuit of lifelong learning had begun. Now, here I would like to just take a few moments to talk about the power of passion. And that is the reason why I've written an entire chapter on the concept of passion in the book as well. So every night, during those 15 months, I remember every single night, I used to apply to a minimum of 3 stock market jobs online. So if you just do the simple math, over 15 months, I had applied to more than 1,300 jobs. I had submitted more than 1,300 job applications. Now, as you know, Guy, every time we take out the time to fill up the application, attach a resume, and every time, single time that we click on the submit button, there is so much hope attached behind every single submission. To face rejections 1,300 times and still keep on going is only and only possible if you're absolutely obsessed or passionate, like I call it, about what you want to do in life, and absolutely sincerely dedicated.
So I want to just pause there and do something that John Lee Dumas of Entrepreneur and Fire does, because Gautam has just given you a value bomb. Value bomb is, in my words, would be that if you found your passion, you'll be able to get through all difficulties and all rejections and all failures. But that only happens when you've found your passion. If it's not your passion, those things will get in the way. Have I expressed that right?
Yes, you have. In fact, it's only when you discover your calling in life, that is when you can actually go the full mile, go the full distance and do these things. Because during those 15 months, a lot of people in India from within family and friends as well had written me off, saying that you have just destroyed your good career. You were earning so much money and doing so well. People tend to confuse having a satisfying career with money. After a certain stage in life, money matters less. There's a concept of diminishing marginal utility which comes in. And there are more meaningful things in life which take over.
Gautam, were you already at that point when you were submitting those job applications? Had you already decided money's not the most important thing? It's pursuing a meaningful life that is the most important thing?
Yes, that is what I said, right? So one finally just came to the realization that I just have this one short life, right? Yeah. Why not live it the way I want to live it? Why should I just be in a job just for the money?
And do you mind if I ask, how old were you at that point?
So this was in 2015. So I was 31 at the time. Yep.
Yeah. So people talk about, in the circles that I moved in New York City, they talked about, quote, the number. So the number at which you don't have to worry about material things anymore. And for different people, the number is at different places. And most people don't get to that number at age 31 unless they've had some extraordinary event like an IPO of Uber or something. But you had gotten there at age 31, which is pretty incredible. You were already not willing to grind your life out doing something you didn't really believe in. But it's worth saying, and this is something that resonates with me a lot, is that you, in a certain way, even though you didn't have results, you were pursuing your passion with no results. You were pursuing your passion. And at the same time, you've got people, friends and family back home who are kind of questioning what you're doing and they think you're mad.
Because they saw my struggle, guys. So I used to live in a paying guest in a single small dingy room in San Francisco on the outskirts. And frankly, I was even then I was happy. People just didn't used to get it. I was still happy because I was finally pursuing what I wanted to pursue in life. Yeah. That is what people, and I'll tell you how I got, and also I would like to share here how I actually got my calling. that this is what I want to do. So I still remember one fine night during the summer of 2016, it was a very stormy, rainy night. And I was in my room reading up a book called Tap Dancing to Work. It was, you know, it's basically a collection of all the Fortune articles on Warren Buffett. And just after finishing the last chapter, I came to know that there was an updated edition of the book, which contained one single additional chapter at the end about women empowerment. I basically came out of my home and went to the local bus stand, waited for more than an hour in the middle of the storm, got drenched in spite of using my umbrella. I took the bus, went all the way down to downtown San Francisco inside a Barnes & Noble bookstore. And I excitedly read the final chapter of the book inside the bookstore to save a few dollars. That is the night when I realized that I had found my calling in life. That was a magical moment for me. That I could not sleep that entire night because the moment of awakening had come finally for me. That this thing makes me so excited. So to go out in a storm and just go all the way downtown just to read one final chapter on a particular person, I know I found my calling in life. So,
but also I think that what you're describing to me are also the first steps in the hero's journey. And I don't know how much familiarity you have, or maybe somebody's just tuning into this. So Joseph Campbell talks about the hero's journey, which is kind of a basic plot line for so many movies and stories. And basically the hero goes on a journey, and that journey isn't a journey of individuation. It's one of adventure. They start learning things, and it's their journey. It's nobody else's journey. So what I'm sensing when you're telling me that is this is a point where you realize that you are on your own path. You're in the midst of creating the Gautam Bade of the future, who's not like anybody who's ever been before, so to speak. I'm describing what I felt when this stuff happened to me, is that you're kind of meeting your destiny in a certain way.
Yes.
You are no longer on a train track. You're not no longer just some blank face. You are you. And when you become you, no hardship is too hard if you know you're on that path, basically.
Absolutely true. And so I was talking about the power of passion. That is what this was all about. Now I would like to talk about something even more important. So
hang on a second. Are you going to go to how, so we're still, so you talk about that thing, but just to say, you know, in our story, you're still working the graveyard shift.
Yes.
So
yes.
You're going to bring us from there to Summit Global Investments.
I'm about to connect. I was about to connect that only. So everything has got a connection. So basically every single chapter of my book is a reflection of my life. Anyone who knows me personally knows that I've written every chapter from the heart because I've actually experienced every single thing. So what I've done is in every single chapter, I've included a personal experience on that particular topic. So that is, I think, what really appealed to the readers. Anyways, so one of my favorite chapters in the book is acknowledging the role of luck, chance, serendipity, and randomness. And those four things have always played a big role in various aspects of my life till date. One fine night during November 2016, while working at the hotel, I randomly clicked on the quick apply button on a particular job opening on LinkedIn. It was for the role of a portfolio manager. And I just randomly clicked on it just in the course of my routine daily online job search. And wonder of wonders, I got shortlisted for the interview, and that too for a senior role in an investment management firm, even though I had zero formal work experience in the stock market. And this was the phase in my life during which I was about to realize the power of compounding knowledge in action. All those hundreds of hours spent reading all those blog articles and white papers for those previous 15 months at the hotel had built a strong intellectual foundation for me in investing. This is what I was lacking during the first 6 months and during those first three stock market job interviews in the US. This time I was able to excel in all the three rounds of my stock market job interview, and I was able to land the job. Now, why did that happen? Because body language derives from confidence, and confidence in turn derives from knowledge. I was offered the role of portfolio manager of global equities, and it was like a dream come true for me. And the icing on the cake was, you know, now from there on, I was getting paid to just love, you know, doing what I do and get paid to learn every day. So it was a wonderful journey of 4.5 years with Summit Global Investments. In fact, just 2 days ago was my last day at work. And now I'm about to embark on the next phase of my journey.
So your book got written during your time at Summit.
Yes.
So Summit Global Investments is in Utah, if I'm Salt Lake City, if that's right. So you move from San Francisco to Utah. And at what point do you start writing your book?
So again, There's a background story here as well. So during the bull market in India from December 2013 to December 2017, I basically achieved financial independence in a very short span of time. Because what happens if you're able to survive, and I tweeted about this recently as well, that if you're able to survive the bear market years, then you're basically done. Because the bull market years will make you super rich. What happens in a bull market year is, if you pick the right stocks, your entire at an aggregate portfolio level, you can actually go up 3-4 times at a portfolio level if you pick the right stocks in a bull market. If you're able to identify the leading sectors of a bull market and pick the leaders within them, you can actually really, really multiply, literally multiply your wealth in a bull market here. So the trick in investing is not to get thrown out of the game. Just stick in there during the bear markets, because bull markets will make you very rich, like they made me during those 4 years from late December 2013 to December 2017. And sharing my learnings was my way of giving back to the investing community, from whom I had gotten to learn so much over the years. And that's why 3 years back, when I self-published the first edition of The Joys of Compounding, I sold it for zero profit. I did not charge any money to cover the costs of production, marketing, distribution, logistics, or to compensate for the hundreds of hours of personal effort. Because the only intention was to help people, nothing else.
When were you writing it? Because it's not a short book. And you know, you get sort of people who may be marketing consultants, or they'll write a book alongside their work, but it's kind of scrappy. Your book is very, very meaty. I mean, every chapter has an enormous amount of work in it. It's a distillation of many different ideas. It shows each chapter has an enormous amount of reading behind it. I can say that I think your book is longer than mine. And my book took me, you could say, 5 years. I mean, I was working as well. And it sounds like your book took less time. I mean, in my mind, given the timeline that you've given me, maybe it's 2 or 3 years max or less, actually. So how does that work?
again, very good question. So basically, like I said, basically during those 15 months, while I was reading the blog articles and those white papers, so I have this personal habit of, you know, just writing things down or collecting my favorite content. And I already had all my favorite content and the favorite bullet points in a Word document with me. That was one thing.
And sorry, Gautam, I just want to pause there because, you know, there are many value bombs that I've just allowed to pass, but this is a value bomb that one is particularly valuable to me, because I think that, you know, who doesn't have valuable thoughts in the shower? But the way that I was until not so long ago is that I'd have these valuable thoughts and I wouldn't do anything with them. And I was saying to somebody, a valuable thought that you have in the shower that you don't write down is a bit like a butterfly that just flies away. And it was fleeting and it was there for a moment. But the idea that we can make our brains hold on to those thoughts for long enough to when we're actually writing is not smart. And so just to bring all of a long wordy idea down to a simple phrase, the capture habit. And I learned this from two people, a guy called Tiago Forte and David Perel, who are online and they tweet and they run these courses. I don't know, you're nodding. Do you know them?
I've heard about David Perel. I do follow his writing. So I think he's a fantastic teacher on the skill of writing. Yes.
And Tiago Forte is kind of like focused on creating a really good note-taking system. And I've gotten far better at my note-taking. And so the value bomb for me and perhaps for the listener is that if you want to do anything that is around writing or communicating, you got to capture the thoughts when they show up. And so, you know, always have something to write down, some way of capturing your thought. Yes. And it doesn't matter how you capture it. It could be in a microphone. It could be on a piece of paper. It could be on your computer, but capture those thoughts.
I had a running notepad on my mobile phone in which I used to keep writing down all the aha moments and eureka moments whenever I used to come across them. In fact, I've written about this in my book as well, that whenever you come across those aha and eureka moments, always write them down, because the brain will not be able to recollect them at a later stage when needed. And these are the insights which lead to, you know, which may lead to a very highly fortunate phase in your investing career, because you'll be able to refer back to your writing, your notes when you require them. So it's very, very important to write things down.
And Gautam, I'll tell you where I've come to on this for what it's worth, is that I now think of my notebooks, my Evernote, even aspects of my Bloomberg monitor, I think of them as thinking tools. So they're a place where I deposit information and insights to come back to them at a later date. And so when I'm writing stuff down, I'm capturing, but I may also be thinking about what does future Guy want to learn from this moment. And And I think that, you know, this is something that it seems like you had that habit early enough that it helped you to write your first book, maybe not your last book. I did not have that habit, but now that I have it, I feel like I'm much more productive for myself. So you were collecting up these notes for a very long time already, is what I hear you saying.
But at that time, I had no idea that I was going to write a book. So like Steve Jobs has said, you cannot connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect the dots looking backward.
Yeah.
Because I have this habit of curating content, my favorite content, always just storing them. It really helped me later, because in November 2016, when I joined Twitter for the first time, I just started penning down my brief thoughts on life, investing, philosophy, psychology, any random thought which used to come to my mind. I just used to start microblogging about it or just writing it down on Twitter. I used to consider Twitter as a place to just store my thoughts for future reference. But suddenly the public started liking what I'm writing, and many of them started writing to me that, you know, why don't you write a blog? Some of them even recommended me to write a book. And during that phase, within a few months of me joining Twitter, two people from India flew all the way down from India to Salt Lake City, Utah, to meet me and thank me for what I'm writing on Twitter. Can you imagine? I mean, it was like an incredible moment for me that here are guys from India who are flying all the way just to thank me for what I'm sharing on Twitter, my thought process. And they really encouraged me to write a book. They said, you know, why don't you write a book? We'll be the first buyers of a book. I thought, more than anything else, I thought, let me just write down my thoughts in an organized way, just to organize my thoughts, and then just share it with the public as a goodwill gesture. Let me just do that. I never expected the book would become so, so popular, guys. Seriously. I mean, that time, there was no idea what was about to happen in the future and how this book was going to change my life.
And, you know, for everyone's benefit, last time I checked, I think you had 200,000 Twitter followers. So obviously what you're doing is resonating. Now, did you know that James Clear, who's written things like Atomic Habits, as I understand it, he basically wrote the whole book on Twitter before he published it. So, and I think that something that I learned from, I think it's David Perel, who kind of said, look, you can treat each tweet as an opportunity to write the perfect sentence. And there's an extraordinary discipline to writing tweets well, if you like. And I know it's fascinating because it's sort of like instant feedback. Because if you write it well, then you get a lot of feedback pretty quickly. And so it's probably changing writing. So your book was written in a certain way in conjunction with the feedback that you were getting. Was Twitter your primary social media outlet, or were there others?
It was primarily Twitter. And I also was present on LinkedIn in a sparse way, but not very active there. It was mainly Twitter, yes.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask you again at the end, but what's your handle on Twitter? If somebody's listening wants to look it up right away.
It's Gautam _Baid, B-A-I-D.
_, basically. Yeah, so it's pretty simple. But I want to go to a second phase on the book writing. So there's capturing thoughts, and you were talking about having them all in a Word document, but then there's editing those thoughts into something that's readable and something that the reader wants to read. And that is actually a very different mindset. So one, when you're capturing thoughts, you should be non-judgmental and just be pretty free-flowing. But then when you're editing, you have to kind of be very critical. And there's a lovely phrase, you have to murder your darling. So you see these beautiful sentences, but you realize that these are not going to help the reader. So you have to delete them. And actually some writers, they have a whole Word document where they put their murdered darlings to sort of like lay them gently to rest in the graveyard of great sentences that never made it to public light. So tell us a little bit about how you ended up editing. How many words did you have in your Word document before you started editing? How did that work?
So the first self-published edition of The Joys of Compounding was like a practice in self-indulgence. It had almost 200,000 words. Yeah. It was only when Columbia University Press decided to publish it, they asked me to reduce the number of words by at least 1/3.
Yeah.
That is when I realized, you know, like just how difficult good writing is. So good writing is hard. It takes time and practice and more time and more practice.
Yes. There's a famous letter that in a book of collected letters in which the guy says, I wanted to write you a short letter, but I didn't have time. So here is a long letter instead. And the writing that takes the most time of all is often poetry, which is the most sparse. So yeah, writing in a way that's clear, removing all the extraneous stuff. I mean, I'm sure that that one third that you removed was bitterly difficult, Gautam.
Yes. So basically, you have to delete all the words and sentences and paragraphs that are not necessary. And it is not an easy task, trust me, because as a writer, we get so attached to so much of our own penned down words that we find it difficult to write down on content. But the whole idea behind making your writing short is just not to make it short. It is to make it better. And you can only be able to delete the the transitory stuff or the ephemeral stuff from your writing only if you're intellectually honest, humble, and sincere, and if you have got your reader's best interests in mind, and if you respect your reader's time. That is when you can actually go and just delete stuff that is not so as to say outstanding, basically what you do not consider as outstanding or adding a lot of value to the reader. All this I'm saying is from point of view of the reader. You just have to put yourself in the reader's shoe and think, is this content really adding value to me? So that is how you have to just be ruthless about editing content. It's not easy though. It's very, very difficult.
It's not. And in my case, I had, I basically had three collaborators. I mean, I had Jessa Gamble initially, and she helped get my content out of me. I used to get up at 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning to write for an hour or two, and she would join me. I had my official editor. And then once the manuscript had been accepted, I was lucky enough to have William Green help me. I mean, he was more than an editor, because there were some chapters that he, he wrote were completely rewritten through a kind of very intensive 3-month collaboration. What's my point to you is that I think that I would have found it very hard to murder my darlings myself. And I think that's why often people get editors, is the editors are far better at helping them focus. And I guess through the life of the book, you eventually did get an editor. The managing editor at Columbia University Press is Miles Thompson. Was he your editor?
He was. And here I would like to add something very personal as an author, that editing is an exercise in humility, because unless you let go of your pride, you will never be able to shorten your writing and shorten the content. You have to let go of your pride and just completely devote yourself, give yourself up to the reader. That is the only dedicated approach to becoming a better writer.
Yeah. And it's a pattern that just keeps on emerging in all sorts of different fields, that it's when you utterly dedicate yourself to a cause, let's say, that extraordinary rewards come in. I mean, two of my heroes, one is Gandhiji, who he's a towering figure, or Nelson Mandela, but it can happen in small ways as well, when somebody who's a professional doctor dedicates themselves to the cause of healing people, that they truly become a shining example when the last bit of ego has been expunged. Of course, that last bit of ego is very, very difficult to expunge, because there's an element to writing a book that ends up being successful, as your book certainly is that, it inflates the ego. And, there's a whole, my experience was that, first of all, to have fans is kind of like, it's a fun experience. It's a pretty shallow experience, but people who just want to meet the author. And I found myself distracted also by activities that were kind of designed to promote the book more than they were designed to live a better life, if you like. And I'm curious to know how you've managed that since the book was published.
It has been a very humbling experience, receiving so much admiration and respect from readers around the world. And I think the expectations have been set very high for future endeavors. And I hope to live up to their expectations. That is the whole idea with which now I've just embarked on the next new journey in my life.
So let's get there. But before we get there, how did your employers at Summit Global Investments feel about your project? And did it help them at all? Did it help their business?
No. This book, in fact, actually, so this is again a personal thing, but this book actually led to a kind of a conflict, because Summit Global Investments, my most recent employer firm, was primarily a quant shop. They believe in algorithms, Excel sheets, machines, and value investing is the complete antithesis of that. We value investors seek to exploit the biases in human behavior, right? So and we don't actually we try to avoid physics envy. So there was a clear conflict, a bit of a tension within the firm during my writing phase and as post the book's publication. But I think as long as I stayed clear of any stock recommendations, they were fine in terms of compliance. But that is the time during which I realized that, there's a bit of a conflict between the culture of the firm and my belief and philosophy and thought process, how I actually approach investing and how Wall Street quant firms approach investing. It's a completely, there are two different worlds basically. Thankfully, for those 4.5 years at Summit Global Investments, I was only in charge of fundamental research and fundamental analysis. So I had nothing to do with the quant side of the business. So that's why I used to really enjoy my work a lot. So I really had a good time there. And I really thank the company for, you know, helping me learn so, so much. It was a great team to work with.
So you're about to start, but now I give you permission, Gautam, to give us the segue into this next phase of your life. Perhaps you can tell a little bit about the story of how that came about and what you're about to embark on, which, just for the listeners' sake, I know we spent about 20 or 30 seconds talking about this before the recording started. So blast away, Gautam, what's next?
So The Joys of Compounding, you know, has become an international bestseller in 5 countries. And it has also got me on the radar of Silicon Valley here in America. There are a lot of tech entrepreneurs here. 3 different tech startups have approached me in the last 6 months. I chose this particular specific one called Chapter, because I believe in the founder's mission. The founder's mission here is basically to make learning very accessible, super affordable to the entire world from across a range of disciplines. So what Chapter basically does is it offers a platform where all the subscribers get curated content and get to learn directly from their favorite authors or thought leaders on a particular subject through an accelerated learning program of 4 weeks. So the idea here is to join the course for 4 weeks and you get access to this curated, shortlisted, best and greatest content from your favorite authors and thought leaders. And you'll also get access to their insights on each particular piece which they have curated. And unlike Twitter, here you'll actually be heard because you can actually interact and pose your questions directly to the course curriculum's teacher, the author in this case, basically. So it's basically a combination of consumer plus social plus edtech. And in my view, this is a huge mega trend, social community. This is a mega trend. I think it's going to become very, very big over the next 10, 20, 30 years. I think technology is going to make many things very socialized, very, very social.
So one surprise and one clarification. So I suppose many people of my and your ilk sitting in your shoes at Summit Global Investing would expect Gautam Baid to leave Summit and start his own fund and to become an investor in one way or another. But that's you chose in a certain way to become an educator rather than investor. And so tell me more about that. What made you choose that path rather than what perhaps would have been more expected by most people?
So you're partly correct. In fact, that is on my radar as well. I do plan to set up an India dedicated fund based out of the United States in the next 6 to 7 months. But this particular opportunity came my way first. And I have always been a great proponent of education and I always liked teaching. I think one of the motivations for writing the self-published edition of the book was that to share learnings with people. And I think a Chapter is going to do a great service to a lot of people around the world, because I think in an era of ever-rising inflation, learning how to invest well, how to think better, how to live a better life, I think all these are becoming necessary life skills. And that is, I think, where Chapter will really come in a big, very big way. So that's the first thing. But I do plan to kickstart the process for setting up the fund, India fund, here in the States very, very soon.
So you will do both. You'll be an investor and you'll also be an educator. But it sounds like the education thing is coming first.
It will come first, yes. It will come first. My way first, yeah.
And then just to get just a better clarification for me. So, you know, I from time to time take start courses, at least. I rarely finish them on Coursera and edX. And every now and then I've looked at Udemy and I've thought about taking a course on Udemy or giving a course on Udemy. And then you have people like Tiago Forte, David Perel, and others who give courses not part of Udemy or anything, but just on their own. So can you help me to understand where Chapter fits into this?
Unlike those other courses you mentioned, this is a much more of an accelerated learning program within just a course of 4 weeks. Plus in Coursera, I don't think you get direct access to, you know, you don't get to actually become part of a forum or a community online where basically all the subscribers get together, interact with each other. It's more like a social forum where the subscribers not only interact with each other, but they also get to pose the author direct questions, unlike Twitter. Basically, there's a huge social element to this, unlike the, you know, many other platforms which do not really have a social element. Here, we are really focusing on the social and together learning aspect in Chapter.
And I haven't taken one of David Perel's courses, but I think that that's a huge part of what he does, is that he puts together a cohort, and the cohort, it's as much about meeting the other people who fellow seekers in the same direction as David is. When is the first Gautam Baid Power of Compounding course going to go out live on Chapter?
So we are, the platform will be going live and will be open for subscriptions from tomorrow. The course titled Discipline of Investing begins on 30th August. So it will be for 4 weeks from the 30th of August. So basically subscribers can pick, choose any month of the year which they want to enroll themselves for this 4 week course. And that's basically how it will operate on a monthly basis.
You did the Power of Investing rather than the Power of Compounding. Out of the curiosity, discipline of investing.
The Joys of Compounding basically talks about many, many things. It's a very exhaustive book. It talks about philosophy, psychology, history, investing. I mean, investing is just one single piece.
Yeah.
But what I really wanted to do was democratize access to information and provide very high quality, specialized knowledge on investing, long term, high quality investing. So that is, I think there's a really a dire need for a course like that. We don't have a very high quality, dedicated course like this available online today, specifically dedicated to value investing. Personally, I feel many people still have value investing all wrong, because many of them read Benjamin Graham's Security Analysis and The Intelligent Investor, forgetting that Graham wrote those books against the background of the Great Depression. What The Intelligent Investor should be used for is to develop the steely resolve and the temperament to become a good investor. But in today's times, you cannot rely on those mathematical formulas to pick stocks, because then you'll end up entering into value traps. That is what happens in the era of information dissemination through the internet. All those cheap stocks are cheap for a reason. Expensive is expensive for a reason. Cheap is cheap for a reason. And every high P stock is not necessarily expensive. And every low P stock is not necessarily cheap.
Yeah,
Value investing is not about buying damaged businesses or declining businesses cheap. It's about getting the greatest amount of value for the price you're paying with the least amount of risk. And the business should be within your circle of competence. That is a one-line summary of value investing. There is nothing else to it. It's very simple.
Yeah, simple but not easy, I think, is what a guy called Michael Oldfield wrote. And I would say that, look, there's a guy called James Currier who talks about network effects as a source of competitive advantage. And he has gone into great detail on the different kinds of network effects that you can get, all the way from your social network down to technology platforms. And so the thing is that, you know, when you have network dominance, then you have an extraordinarily valuable business. But when you have five companies that are all spending vast amounts of money trying to get network dominance, and they're all losing money, and each one of them is telling the investors that they will get network dominance, and at that point, the high valuation that you're paying, it's a very strange analysis, because in some cases, maybe, you know, Google coexists with Amazon, coexists with Apple. But Google did not coexist with Alta Vista, Netscape, Yahoo. I mean, a whole bunch of people fell by the wayside. So you get the network in any case. That's a whole other area of discussion. But, you know, in a certain sense, what I tell people is that everything that I learned until about 2008-09 could be, you know, it had a very, very limited shelf life. And so for a young analyst or investor coming into the world today, their relative disadvantage to me, let's say, is not that great. Whereas my relative disadvantage, I think, in comparison to Warren Buffett and others, was huge, because their knowledge actually meant something. Whereas a lot of the knowledge, in any case, that's a whole different topic. But you know, I actually think that the most important lessons of what those classic books is less about value traps or how to invest, and more about how to live your life, which is what The Power of Compounding is really about. And that's something that I just really loved. And there's a chart where you kind of show how you kind of like, you start on this journey and you have what you might call is a valley of despair, in which if you have passion, as you just described, it's not a valley of despair. But I kind of tell people you have to go through potentially as long as 20 years worth of investing in The Power of Compounding before it starts paying off. And I think it probably starts paying off way sooner than 20 years. But if you're not willing to make the investment for that period of time, it's probably not going to work out for you. And I actually, Gautam, tried an experiment. I would have all sorts of interns come into my office and write thank you notes to all sorts of people, but I don't think one of them decided to stick with that program, even though in a number of examples, even during the internship, there were extraordinary rewards. In one story, the intern was interested in the fashion industry, and one of the guys he wrote to is an Italian business owner who has, they produce very, very special ties. And you know, that my intern got a gift. The guy was so pleased to get a note because my intern wrote to him saying, you know, you're a great example of what I hope to be sometime in the future. And you set a great example for the industry. Thank you, was what my intern wrote. The guy was so delighted that he sent my intern five ties, which is kind of like a $200 value per tie. So he's kind of had like $1,000 worth of gifts from this guy. But my question to you is, and this is something that I've been challenged with, and for the listener, Gautam doesn't know what I'm about to ask him, but when you start benefiting from compounding, then my experience has been is that you don't know what to do with the wealth of stuff that the world throws back at you. So for example, I decided that I was going to write three thank you notes a day. You were applying to three jobs a day, I was writing three thank you notes a day. When you write thank you notes, you get a lot of reciprocation. If you think that I've been doing thank you notes in one way or another now for more than a decade, and if you take it at three a day, I'm not sure what the exact number is, that's an awful lot of reciprocation, and people reciprocate in all sorts of ways. So every day I come into the office, there's things coming in. And like, you know, you talked with surprise at how suddenly you got two guys showing up from India. And so my question is, some of those meetings are wonderful, but some of the stuff that comes back at you is draining. And I'm curious to know how you deal with the stuff that comes back at you that is of the draining variety.
So the main thing to do with the draining aspect is primarily high expectations. I think people have got very, very high expectations, and you have to act as a moral exemplar for them, because I need to walk the talk. If I'm writing about living life as per the Innes Cook in my book and living up to very high standards in the book, then I have to actually follow it in real life, you know, because people nothing is hidden from people now. I mean, you cannot just fake it anymore. You have to be true to yourself and live a life aligned with your value system. And that is not easy for most people. Most people are living life as per the outer scorecard, not as per the inner scorecard. And those people's masks will inevitably fall off. Now, before I continue, I would just like to add two specific things to this discussion, just to add to what you were talking about a while ago. You were talking about people who just cannot keep on going and they give up. So Thomas Edison had basically said that many of life's greatest failures are people who did not realize how close they were to success when they actually gave up. But in my book, I write and I quote, never give up after putting in all the hard work and effort, because compounding will bestow all its great rewards upon you only after testing your patience and conviction to the fullest. You have to go through the initial value of disappointment, which I show in that chart you talked about, because you need to get on the exponential part of the curve. The magic in compounding basically starts happening once you're on the exponential part of the curve. That is when you start going vertical. And what happens is, if you're a person with a good heart, if you actually have a genuine intent to help people, once you become rich through compounding wealth, once you become financially independent, you can make a huge difference to the lives of people. I'll give you 3-4 personal examples here. So 3 years back, when I spent more than $15,000 out of my pocket, that time it was a decently meaningful sum of money for me out of my pocket. And I sold it for zero. I was able to afford to sell the book for zero profit because I was already financially independent through the power of compounding wealth. That's number one. Number two, when Columbia Business University Publishing and me were signing the agreement, I myself told them, just minimize my royalties. Now, I don't know which authors do that. I myself told them, just try to crush down my royalty per book because I want to make it as affordable as possible. When Columbia University Press outlicensed the book publishing rights to HarperCollins India, what happened last year was, when the hardcover was being released in India, it was being sold at a very expensive price by Indian standards, the hardcover. So I basically started coordinating between HarperCollins in India and the local printing house in India and the Columbia University Press editors here, that why don't you out-license your rights to HarperCollins India to make the book super affordable. So from an initial price of $28 in India, the paperback now costs just $4 a copy. I simply told HarperCollins, give me zero royalty. I don't want any single penny of royalty from you. Just make sure that the book is between $4 and $5, because I am here to democratize knowledge. I'm not doing this for the money anymore. By God's grace, I have enough. And in the last few years, you know, whenever I've been invited by corporates like Qualcomm, Intel Corporation, Adobe Systems to the campuses to give talk to the employees, I often tell them one important thing that many of you guys in the audience may be earning more money than me, but you will never have what I already have, which is enough. I've defined my enough in life. And now I'm very content. Contentment and peace of mind is the ultimate status symbol, the ultimate wealth guy. I'm telling you, that is the ultimate form of wealth. Being content with what you have in life.
You know that you've just, I don't know if you probably have the book on your shelf behind you, the book by John Bogle called Enough.
You know, I've read that book. It's not on my bookshelf, but I've read it. It's in that he narrates about this incident at a party, and that is where that story comes from. Even in chapter, basically, you know, for this 4-week course, I could have easily charged hundreds of dollars, given many people do respect my views, but I just priced it so ridiculously low. It's a $40 course. You're getting basically, my idea here was to provide more than 100 times the value to the subscribers, you know, basically charge $40 per person, but provide them with more than 100 times the value. Because I'm always, my mind is now clearly focused on the long-term gain. I'm always now thinking very, very, very long-term. Everything that I do in life, I'm thinking long-term, long-term, long-term. I'm looking at positive win-win games. I'm looking at win-win relationships. And this is the greatest learning which I've taken away from the Berkshire Hathaway meetings and from Buffett and Munger and people like you and Monish and other people, that when you help others unconditionally, what happens is the universe works in such a way so as to come back and reward you back multiple times over. That is, it's a magic, but many people just don't believe in this because it takes time. People don't have the patience.
Gautam, I can tell you that happened with me with your book. So I saw somebody that I'd never heard of before had written a book, and I took the time to write a blurb.
Yes.
And I just said here, you know, use it, don't use it. I hope you can use it to get the best possible blurb. Warren Buffett should read my blurb, and then he should blurb your book. And then the next thing I know, I'm on the cover, and I'm like blown. You know, it was. And again, I had not done what I did, asking for anything in return, and suddenly you're kind of returning it to me, or maybe the universe. So I absolutely get that, and I sense. Your excitement, because once you've discovered that that's how the universe works, it's kind of super exciting because you get up every day saying, I get up every day with new ideas about how to make that process work and how to get better at it and where is my best and highest use. And so what's worth saying is that Gautam, as best I can tell, is not applying for 3 jobs a day anymore. And I'm no longer writing 3 thank you notes a day, but I'm still thinking every day about how can I give stuff? What am I best placed to give unconditionally in a way that makes the universe a better place? So I've been doing it now really in earnest for 15 years. And I still think I haven't reached my growth spurt, if you like. So I think there's a point at which it does go kind of asymptotic. So you kind of think of Warren Buffett going, you know, and I'm sort of using wealth as a proxy for all these other things, but from, you know, 300 million to 3 billion to 30 billion. Well, you know, the 3 billion to 30 billion is kind of like asymptotic. It's just, it goes through the roof. And that all can happen at the very, very end of a long and happy life, if you like. But I want to go back to my original question, which is, so you talked about walking the talk. And if you walk the talk, I'll just give one example. I'm walking down the street in Manhattan. Somebody recognizes me and he's a lovely guy. And really I had the time to stop and chat with him for 10, 15 minutes. And I think that if I had not have had time, I would have said, look, I'm really sorry. I got to run, but so great to meet you. Give me your card and I'll connect to you. But a lot of the people, so your book is selling for $4 a book in India. You'll have an enormous number of Indians who feel grateful to you for having written the book, but you could not shake every one of their hands because you'd be exhausted. You'd spend half a year just shaking hands. So how do you deal with that, I guess?
Well, it's through constant education and just trying to be nice to people and just trying to respond to as many of the queries on Twitter as I can. I think that's one, but that is a much more bigger thing which I have in my mind. So I don't know if you're aware of this phenomenon called small case in India. So in the last 10, 15 years, the mutual fund industry in India has given very subpar returns. And There's a fintech company in South India, in the city of Bangalore, which is named Smallcase. They basically SEBI registered investment advisors and research analysts register with Smallcase, and they offer model portfolios to retail investors in exchange for a small subscription fee. And I think that is also, you know, if you just are able to provide that model portfolio service at a very reasonable fee, that's also, you know, I think a very good way to uplift a lot of people out of their middle class status to a more prosperous status. And that is also something which I'm working on right now. I've already applied with SEBI in India for the license. So if that comes about, I do want to get into that particular service as well and help a lot of people, because ever since the book got published in India, in the last 6 months, it's sold more than it's touching almost 30,000 copies in just 6 months.
Yeah.
And I've received hundreds of emails from readers asking if I can offer them a Smallcase offering. So again, even though I don't need to do it, but I just thought, you know, why not just, you know, share my expertise with people, you know, through this particular offering. So I'm just in the middle of the SEBI registration process. Let's see how that goes.
So what I take away from that is that in terms of walking the talk, so there, it's actually looking at ways to scale up. So what you're talking about there is that, you know, you can help a lot of Indian investors by creating a model portfolio. And, you know, you may not be writing individual notes to every one of them, but you're helping them all in one way or another. And if I take the example of Warren Buffett, you know, he cannot meet with every single one of his investors personally, but he does do a wonderful event once a year in which we all get to hang out in the same stadium together with Warren. And so that's kind of a way of scaling up. What it's worth saying is that Warren doesn't give up on the personal notes. He still does that. He obviously can't get to everybody that he'd like to. And something else that, I mean, I think it's a constant learning process. So I could not sort of like walk my talk without a small team that helps me to walk my talk. And I didn't understand that for the longest time, that I needed help in walking my talk, if you like. And that's one way to scale up, but even then it has its limitations. So
the main idea behind what I'm trying to do differently is just to make it very accessible and super affordable. So for example, even in the India fund, which I'm planning to have zero management fee, just to make it, you know, super fair and affordable. Similarly, in case of the Smallcase offering, right now there are many Smallcase creators in India who are charging astronomical fees for subpar, you know, subpar performance. Why not deliver people great value? My only point is, if you want to succeed in life, you know, you have to think of offering value, great value to others rather than to yourself. Yeah, that is how you get ahead in life. It's an ironical thing, but that's how it works. Instead of playing the short-term game, play the long-term game. Try to provide far, far more value than what you're receiving. In the long run, you'll do exceptionally well.
And so, Gautam, are you going to stay in Salt Lake City or will you be moving?
As of right now, I'll be based in Salt Lake City, but in the future, if need be, I may move, but no concrete plans as of now.
And any plans to move back to India or will you stay in the United States?
I do plan to stay in the United States. I'll be getting my US citizenship and US passport in the next 2-3 months.
Congratulations. And so I want to close with, again, a very, very different question to the ones that I've been asking up to now. So you grew up in India, you were looking at international investments for Summit Global. This conversation comes at a time when people are questioning exactly what kind of capitalist system will emerge out of China. We know that the so-called Communist Party of China is extraordinarily capitalist. We've also learned, so in the recent weeks, the for-profit education industry or the tutoring industry in China has been quite badly hit, basically because of edicts coming from senior levels in the Chinese Communist Party. And I guess I'd love to hear, just for the fun of it, and it's dangerous, I know, because this content is likely not to stand the test of time because the world changes, but can you give the perspective of an Indian who's grown up in India, living in the United States? Where do you think China goes from an investment perspective and being investable?
I think the short term looks very turbulent. As you rightly said, they have basically turned all the for-profit education companies into non-profit in order to democratize and access to education and make it super affordable. At the same time, if you see what they did with the founder of Alibaba and with Ant Financial IPO, it's very clear that China is trying to control the access to data. You know, all these fintech companies in China have got large amounts of consumer data, And in China, basically, I think the government doesn't really want to democratize the access, you know, the control, you know, or rather allow the huge control of data in the hands of a few select corporations. And that is why you have seen stocks, great stocks like Tencent, Alibaba getting derated. Great franchises, great businesses, great business models. We know about Alipay, we know about AliCloud, we know about Tencent Music. But we saw recently what happened. Tencent Music, I think, just put some fundraising plans on hold, just abruptly. That is what happens. You know, in the short term, market is driven by sentiment. And right now, sentiment is very badly damaged. Even though the stocks have become very attractive from a long-term perspective, in the short term, sentiment has been badly damaged. And that's why these great business models are getting derated very sharply in this Chinese markets. I personally like to follow Warren Buffett's dictum that I don't like to jump over 7 feet hurdles. I like the small, cute, tiny 1 feet hurdles, which I can just step over. And for me personally, that is India, because we are a very vibrant economy, a thriving democracy, and great investment opportunities. I feel very blessed and fortunate to have been brought up in that country. That is the country which I'm super bullish on. That fund market, I'm super bullish on. The entire world stock market, and I've tracked global stock markets for 4.5 years here in Summit Global Investments. India is one which I'm extremely bullish about. I think India's time has arrived.
I think that India's time arrived ever since Manmohan Singh kind of like rejigged India. It was the India's who cares what color the cat is, as long as it catches the mouse, so to speak. There's no question that India, for all of its faults and all of its difficulties, it's almost like vibrant for me is not the, it is vibrant. It's extraordinarily vibrant, but there's basically a system of, there's the Western system of an elected government and administrators who are non-political and a court system. And so more or less, in spite of the colonial history, India's modeling itself on some kind of Western democratic country. Whereas China, you know, I think it came as an enormous shock to a lot of people that basically the edicts of the Communist Party are law. There's no checks and balances. It's just what...
And capital is always attracted to countries and places where there is rule of law and access to civil and property rights. Where do you have those in China anymore? Are you seeing any evidence of those rights in China? Investors are clearly cognizant of that fact. And that is why they are withdrawing money in droves from the Chinese markets. Yeah. It may benefit the other emerging markets. So if you look at the MSCI Emerging Market Index, 36% of the weight is in China. 14% is in Taiwan. 13% is South Korea. 10% is with India. What I feel is going to happen is a lot of capital is going to get reallocated because global fund managers tend to do a lot of rebalancing. A lot of that money may shift to more stable markets like South Korea or India out of China.
I think that, and I love saying this, of course, and to the extent that more Indians tune into this, because you're well known in India, my Indian friends will enjoy hearing this. I think that India, we haven't really, the world is so focused on China that and India's and China's populations are approximately, I think India's is 100 million behind China, according to the last numbers that I read, but who cares? It's still extraordinarily large numbers, a high percentage of the global population. And basically, in spite of all the different languages that are spoken locally in India, India can be taken from a business perspective to be an English-speaking country. So much of the country's business is conducted in English. At some point, I think you can make the case that India becomes the world's largest English-speaking economy. And you know, that mantle was passed at some point from the United Kingdom to the United States. And at some point, that mantle will be passed from the United States to India. And I think that that may come with some really interesting changes. It may be that in the same way that I went to the United States to study for my MBA, maybe in the future there'll be people who don't have a particular interest in India in and of itself. They just want to get the best education possible. We'll be looking to Indian institutions, or it may be that London becomes a bit like a Delaware in which a lot of corporate law is done. But it's quite possible. I mean, London is a far older center for law than the United States is, but Delaware has become an important center for corporate law for corporations whose businesses barely touch the United States. And so we're talking about 50 years plus into the future, but I think it's quite possible that we'll see similar developments in India, where India becomes a kind of well, China calls itself the Middle Kingdom, but it might be that India becomes a kind of a Middle Kingdom, and it's actually better placed between China and the West for that to happen. So I agree that India's got extraordinary opportunities, and it's a fun place to invest. But I just thought I'd ask you about China. Gautam, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. This has been so much fun and so interesting for me. I feel like I need to reread your book. It's certainly worth rereading because it's the kind of book containing timeless wisdom that every time you read it, you learn something new. In notwithstanding the questions that I've asked you, if people want to stay in touch, can you just tell us about, I guess you want to tell us about the course and how, what is the best way to engage with you? I'd like to tell the listener that if you have not yet already left a review for Gautam's book on Amazon or similar, please do go and leave a review. It makes a difference to us authors. It's one of the great ways you can appreciate somebody's writing. So that's an easy thing that I can ask you to do. And obviously buy Gautam's book. You'll be wiser for it. And give it to all your friends and relatives and clients. But Gautam, if any one of those people, after having bought your book and after having reviewed it, wants to get in touch with you or engage with you, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. They can reach me through Twitter or LinkedIn, or they can email me at Gautam@thejoysofcompounding.com.
And we'll have those links in the notes to the episode. Gautam, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you so much, Guy. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking out the time to write the foreword to the book. I think it was a very humbling experience. And thank you so much for your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Gautam.